we are careening through these topics at breakneck speed. We did a one-day exploration of class and gender, hardly scratching the surface, and my falling prey to the effort to pack way more into a single class rather than to just decide, okay, I can't do everything, so let's just not even broach certain topics. The trilogy, Race, Class, and Gender, has become the kind of anchors for critical thinking in the last decades. Almost everyone who takes a progressive, critical, leftish stance towards social problems within sociology and other social sciences will recognize that these are three distinct kinds of relations within which all sorts of harms are generated, and the transformation of these relations are the object of critical emancipatory theory. So this is really at the kind of moral core, I think, of much, if not all, of the contemporary critical social theory. The one domain of critical theory that really is outside of this, although it does connect, is around the environment. Environmentalism does sometimes talk about environmental justice, but that's a pretty marginal strand, perhaps of increasing salience, but still it's really on the margins of the environmental critique of contemporary society. There is a tendency sometimes to kind of get into a mode of thinking which sometimes is called laundry list oppressions, where you have this long list and you keep adding things. So there's class, race, and gender, physical disability, religion, nationality, ethnicity. You can see ageism. There's nothing wrong. I mean, I certainly don't have an objection to saying we need as nuanced and comprehensive an understanding of the sources of harm that are generated by existing institutions and relations. Of course, and we should be attentive to all of them. I do think, however, that something gets lost by taking a stance which says these are all of equal standing with respect to the problem of understanding how the world is working and what are the obstacles to change. They each have their specificity, but there is, I think, reason to pay specific attention to race, class, and gender as the core of the problem. Now, you can say that while recognizing that for some people, their life will be more deeply stamped by the social relations and practices around something else. So a person with significant physical disabilities whose impairments make it very hard to flourish in the world as it is, for them, it's absolutely appropriate to say, yes, the problem of access and of accommodation is the central problem that they face in their life. In oppression, around these different dimensions of disadvantage and harm and oppression, there's very complex psychological aspects as well. If you ask in a survey children, which of the following disabilities would you prefer to have if you had to have one? And you can't do anything about it. So you can't, it's not a disability which then through hard work you could eliminate, right? So what would be, being grossly obese is for many people worse than being paraplegic. And that really shows, I mean, that's a psychological issue, I think. It shows the issue of shame that's attached to certain kinds of, and stigma, that's attached to certain kinds of conditions and not others. And people are more worried about being seen as disgusting in some way than they are as being just impaired. So there's a lot of complicated issues that are bound up with these. On the issues of race and gender and class, I think more work needs to be done to identify the deep specificities to each of these that distinguish the nature of these forms of relations and the harms which they generate. rather than just talking about intersectionality and how they come together. Just to give one illustration of this, there are some very special things about gender that are really absent in both race and class, namely that some of the most robust solidarities in the world cross gender lines. That is, the solidarities that people express within families in their willingness to die for each other, you know, to make huge sacrifices for the well-being of another, where the sense of self is entirely dependent upon the well-being of someone else, across a line, a social cleavage or relation, which also has oppressive elements to it in the society at large. Now, that's a really quite distinctive. That's not true about class. It just is not true that the solidarities across classes, the sense of deep concern about the well-being of your boss and your willingness to die, you know, that's just not a property of class relations. And it's not a property of race relations. Indeed, a property of race relations is of these three kinds of relations within which harms are generated, it's the relation which is most fueled by actual hatred and disgust. You know, really intense negative emotion gets structured around race in ways that it's just extremely rare around around class. You do get, of course you get antagonism, but so each of these has its specificity. And it's important in gender analysis to recognize the strength of those reciprocities and solidarities across the social division which the relation defines as coexisting with the harms and the domination that is also associated with that relation. Well, today we're going to talk about race. And race is a good topic on which to think carefully about this issue of theoretical specificity. What is it that makes a racial division a racial division as opposed to some other kind of division? In 2003, there was a United Nations conference on racism in which there was a resolution proposed at the conference by a number of delegations which stated that Zionism is a form of racism. That led to the walkout of a number of countries. They refused to participate in a conference in which that was on the table, let alone where it was passed. Many people disregarded this as absurd. You know, it was just a ridiculous statement, not even worthy of discussions. Others felt it captured some deep theoretical unity between Zionism and other more generally accepted forms of racism. And that's what the problem of theoretical specificity is. So one can certainly say Zionism is a form of oppression. It bears a lot of similarity with colonialism in certain parts of the world in terms of its regard for the indigenous people that happen to be living on a piece of land. There's lots of other isms it could be considered congruent with. The one that had this real salience, the accusation that had the kind of salience that led people to walk out, delegations to walk out, was its identification with racism. I don't think saying Zionism is a form of colonialism would have had the same effect. People might have argued about it, but the descriptive congruence between an ideology that said that people who had been living in Europe for many, many generations had a right to move to another place where other people were already living, well, that does have quite similarities with white settlers coming from Europe to other parts of the world. There would have been debate, but I don't think it would have had the kind of ideological bite that identifying Zionism with racism had. Of course, part of the reason for the bite of that particular accusation was precisely because Jews in Europe had been the victims of such intense forms of racism themselves. And so the accusation that the founding ideology of the Israeli state, of the Jewish state in the Middle East, was also an instance of racism, was one that was seen as intolerable by people who were defenders of Israel. So that's one of our tasks, is to try to figure out how do we diagnose social relations in order to say, yes, this is an instance of this more general category. This brings up an issue which causes a lot of aggravation in social theory, the problem of what's called essentialism. This is, I think, a methodological implication of any kind of classification exercise. The theoretical specificity of a particular concept or category depends upon how it figures in some theoretical problem. You derive the specificity of a concept from how it's going to fit into some broader kind of argument. To argue that a particular category has a particular definition irrespective of theoretical purposes is what some people would call essentialism. Often I think it's just sloppy thinking rather than essentialism. So two things should be classified together if it is the case that they identify some kind of causal process within a social phenomenon under some common causal process within a social phenomenon under investigation. It may turn out when you push this that some common sense everyday distinctions dissolve and other things which look very similar on the surface turn out to be very different. That's what discoveries around classifications entail. So there was a time when tuna and dolphin were both called fish. They're about the same size. They swim in the same sea. The Mediterranean has both tuna and dolphin. And there was a time when they were both considered fish. And if your classification system had as its salient theoretical category, we want a name for all things that swim in the sea, and we'll call those things fish, then that's perfectly legitimate. There's no reason why you can't say these are both the same kind of animal. What kind are they? They're sea swimming animals. It just turns out that that's a very superficial and not very useful way of saying what do these things have in common. And a much deeper classification, deeper in the sense that it's identifying underlying causal processes in a more profound way, is to group mice and dolphins together, which on the face of it is absurd, right? Mice and dolphins, they don't look anything alike. But it turns out that from the point of view of many, probably most scientific purposes, not all, but for most scientific purposes, for most explanatory purposes, understanding that these are both mammals tells you way more about the nature of the concrete animals that you're talking about. So that's what we need to think about. What is the abstract category within which race is an example, so that we can know whether any particular instance of social antagonism across a cleavage of some sort, whether any particular instance should be thought of as an example of a racial antagonism, of a racial relation. And all of this is needed in order to then begin to seriously think about the connection between race and class. Right? So the purpose of this session is not so much to delve fully into the concept of race as such, but to understand its connection to class. Now, one thing to say right from the start, before we kind of pursue this question of what is the more abstract concept within which race then is an instance, race is compared to a number of other possible divisions, all of which fall under some general category, is to just explicitly state a point which I think is probably well known to nearly all of you, and that's the notion that race is a social category, not a biological one. That racial classifications are always social socially constructed. That's the standard way of describing it. The racial classifications are social constructions, not given by biology. That doesn't mean that it's not a social construction that works on biology, on biological difference. It just means that it's the actual classification systems and the rules which govern the classification system are produced by social convention, not by biology. This is very similar to the distinction between sex and gender. Gender relations are socially created, but of course they're socially created against a background, a context, the raw material, so to speak, of that social creation is biological difference between males and females. So in the sex and gender case, you have a biological difference between males and females, which in the first approximation is binary. In a more complicated understanding of sex differences, it's not. But then social practices transform that raw material into a set of social categories, which we call genders. Race has exactly that parallel idea, that there are some kinds of biological differences between human beings, which are the raw materials which then racial classification systems transform into socially recognizable categories. The classic way of describing this is the peculiar way in the United States that race has been constructed. We have with respect to people of African descent, a binary concept of race. A person is either black or white. And the historic way of defining that binary is any black ancestry makes you black. That was referred to in the Jim Crow era as the one drop rule. So that if you had any African ancestry at all, then you would be black. Now one could imagine a racial order which had a one drop white rule. So you can imagine the racist ideology that could animate that. Instead of one drop of black ancestry contaminating you, one drop of white ancestry could purify you. You could have a white purification ideology. You could be equally racist, equally stigmatizing of African descent. But it would have such a lofty view of the purification that comes from white ancestry that it would neutralize whatever liabilities you would have had from African descent. Well, that's not the way racism works, but it would have created a one-drop white rule. It's perfectly symmetrical. It has the same biological input as the existing one, but there'd be no African Americans. You know, virtually none. There'd be some African Americans of recent immigrant status, but there's, probably it's just a tiny fraction of African Americans of long-standing American descent who don't have some white ancestry. And so we would we'd have this view of the world where whites come in all sorts of shades, that's not noted as racial difference. It's just difference. If you had such a racial classification system. From a biological point of view, the point is that is absolutely symmetrical with the way we do it. But it would have totally different demography as a result. Okay, racial classifications are socially constructed, but what are they? How should we think about them? One proposal, which I think is pretty interesting as a way of kind of beginning this project, of classification, is the one that Michael Albert and Robin Hanel propose. It's not standard. This is not, their proposal never got into the literature as one of the contending ways of thinking about racial categories and how racial categories are constructed. But I actually think it's a pretty interesting idea. The basic idea is this. So I'll give you the Albert and the synoptic character of the Albert and Hanel proposal and then show how we can use it to to get at this question, what is the specificity of the distinctively racial form? The racial form of what is what we're addressing here. So here's the idea. The very core of social life is the idea of community. The circle of people with which one regularly cooperates and feels bonds of trust and solidarity. That's what they mean by community. The circle of people that provide the basic building blocks of social interaction and reciprocity. So we're a social species. To live, we have to engage in deep cooperation with people. There is a circle of people with whom we engage in such cooperation in a face-to-face, organic way that involves lots of dense reciprocities and mutual expectations of recognition and regard. People who you can trust. You know that if you need some help, you can ask them and you're not going to get slapped in the face. Right? So there's a circle of sociability that becomes the micro fabric of everyday cooperation. This is a result of our evolutionary history. At its most fundamental level, this social cooperation of community is anchored in face-to-face relations and reciprocities. And this reaches back to our hunting and gathering past. You know, if you just think of what it was like to be a human being 50,000 years ago, all human beings 50,000 years ago lived in small hunting and gathering communities with very deep reciprocities and social bonds that defined a communal circle. Now, of course, this idea can be extended to a much broader array of circles. We don't live in hunting and gathering bands, by and large. So with this very general idea, communal identity, an identity that gets built up around such reciprocities and bonds, refers to the criteria one uses to decide what sorts of people fall into this category of community and what sorts do not, who's in and who's out. You can have multiple communal identities. They can overlap, they can be disjoint. There's no reason why you can only have one. But each of them does bring with it a definition of inclusion and exclusion. Exclusion doesn't mean hatred or antagonism, it just means they're not part of the circle of people with whom one feels that sense of reciprocity and mutual support. Now, defined in this way, community and communal identity doesn't imply anything about oppression. It's just about sociability and cooperation. The question then is, under what circumstances and in what ways does communal identity become the basis for oppression? It becomes the basis for oppression when it gets combined with mechanisms of domination and exclusion, the connection, domination and exclusion as connected ideas. One might want to call this an alienated form of community. So just as we can think of class as an alienated form of the division of labor and male domination as an alienated form of gender relations, that is, gender relations, the gender division of labor gets linked to mechanisms of domination. So male domination is an alienated form of what could be relations of reciprocity. So too can communal identity become a form of alienated solidarity, a solidarity that forms the basis of domination and exclusion rather than just reciprocity. There are many different ways this can happen then. Ethnicity, religion, language, nationality, tribe, all of these can, in certain situations, become forms of communal identity which constitute the basis of domination and exclusion. Racial domination, then, in Albert and Hanel's view, is one specific type of this broader form of communal division and domination. Now, that proposal then says the broader category within which racial domination is a specific instance is communal identities transformed into forms of communal domination of one category of people by another. The basis for that could be religion. The basis for that could be nationality. The basis for that could be tribe, clan, or, by the way, race. Race becomes one of a variety of ways in which the unalienated form of reciprocities and sociability that is at the very core of all social life becomes organized in such a way that it constitutes a form of domination over an excluded group. That's their proposal for how to think of the broader category within which race is an instance. That then opens up the question, what is it that distinguishes racial domination from other forms of communal domination? So this would be a way of distinguishing racial domination from nationalist domination or from ethnic domination or from religious domination, all of which can be murderous. I mean, religious domination can be as bad as anything. Religious identities formed as communal solidarities deployed to dominate others can be as vicious as racial identities formed to dominate. But they're different. They have a different social foundation. It's based on different kind of reciprocity, different sorts of relations. Okay, so the first step is to propose the broad category within which race is one type. And note that this way of doing it, the Albert and Hanel proposal, is not just saying that the broad category is domination, of which this is one type. Rather, the broad category is communal domination, of which this is one type. One could have even a more abstract type, which is just any social relation within which one category of people dominate another. So class constitutes an instance of that very broad type. But class is not really rooted in communal identity. It's rooted in control over the means of production and other relationships to economic practices. It's not rooted, class domination is not rooted in communal identities being then used as a basis for domination and exclusion. So then the question is, what distinguishes race from other types of communal oppression? And this is point four under Roman numeral two, the specificity of racial oppression. So here I'll give you a list of different kinds of communally based divisions which can be the source of conflict and oppression or domination. So black and white in the US, Jew and Muslim in Israel, Palestine, anti-Semitism in Europe, Catholic, Protestant in Northern Ireland, Hutu and Tutsi in Rwanda, untouchable castes in India. So all of these are forms of, certainly of conflict, arguably of oppression. They all involve the deployment of communal identities. But which of these constitute instances of racial oppression? You can see that in the absence of some theoretical agenda or explanatory purpose, the question is pretty hard to resolve. You know, this has to be embedded in some kind of broader agenda in order to even know what the question really means. I'll give a provisional definition of racial oppression, at least as I've grappled with it. But I think the boundary conditions, the criteria for what's included in or not under the rubric racial oppression, this may shift depending upon the specific explanatory context. But let me give you the provisional definition as I would frame it. And I've put this in the outline in more detail than usual for the outline, just so you know have it on paper. First, racial division is a socially recognized distinction between people based on biological lineage. Now, note, this first point is not based on biological attributes. It's based on biological lineage. You are born into a racial category by virtue of the racial category of your parents. So that's the first point. It's an ascriptive category into which you are born. And to answer the question, what is the race of a child? The answer is, what are the races of the parents? That is, it's by virtue of some descent rule in which you know the race of a child by virtue of the race of their parents. It's ascriptive is the standard sociological term for that. Although there are special cases in some racial orders in which there are standard ways to escape your lineage. And to the extent that that's part of the rules of the game of a racial classification system, that is, there are ways to escape it, to change your race, then I think it begins to dissolve the boundary of it being really a racial classification system as opposed to a race-like classification system. Racial classification systems, I think, as such, are descents through biological lineage. This is obviously socially constructed rather than natural. They always, even though that's true, they always constitute a transformation of the raw material of biologically based lineages. And the one drop rule is the US example. So in the US, a person of pure European ancestry and a person of African ancestry who have a child, the child acquires their race from the race of the parents, but with the particular socially constructed rules we have, the race of the child is determined entirely by the race of one of the parents, not both of the parents. Okay, that's the first point. Second point, typically the biological lineage is linked to some socially recognized and symbolically salient physical attribute, which are called phenotypes in the kind of biological literature. But this need not be the case. Need not be the case. Anti-Semitism in Europe was not linked to any consistent visible phenotypic characteristics. Although there was always, as part of European anti-Semitism, a stereotyped Jewish look, you know, that in Nazi propaganda they would always have a caricature of what was seen as the prototypical Jewish appearance, but that wasn't the criterion for being Jew. You didn't have to match that stereotype. You could be blue-eyed and blonde and be Jewish in, according to the Nazi view of biological lineage, yeah.
Are you classifying it?
Well, it's a candidate for racism because it certainly identifies the race of a child by the race of the parents. You know, so it does see it as a biological lineage. A convert, but if you can't convert out of it, and it's not so clear whether, you know, there's ambiguity. If you were of sort of pure Christian stock, you know, disgusting language, but and converted to Judaism and then deconverted, you probably wouldn't be considered Jewish by the Nazis. You just made a mistake. But you can't convert out. And that was a distinctive feature. This is a little bit of a side point. It's a distinctively different feature of the Nazi form of anti-Semitism from earlier Christian anti-Jewish. In the Spanish Inquisition, Spanish Jews who converted to Christianity, the first generation was viewed with suspicion. The conversos were viewed with suspicion because opportunism would be an obvious reason why people might convert. But the second generations were pretty much not. And by the third generation, they were fully part of the Catholic world. And so it was less of a purely racial and more of a religious form of domination in the Spanish Inquisition compared to the Nazi anti-Semitism, in which the religious component really played a way secondary role, you know, which is why the Nazis would group Jews along with other racial racially defined categories and treat them as essentially a block, whereas that was not the case in at least some currents of earlier anti-Jewish sentiment among Christian populations in Europe. Okay, so the second point is that there's typically a marker, a physical marker, and that's understandable. A form of domination that's rooted in biological descent. Biological descent does bring physical markers with it. Usually this would be characteristic of a group as a whole. So that's why racial classifications often rely on things like skin color or facial features and so on. But sometimes that gets pretty weak. That's the second point. Third point, racial division. So far, the first two criteria don't give you domination. It just gives you distinction, difference. Racial division becomes racial oppression when it corresponds to some form of socially significant exclusion, typically with an economic dimension. That's almost always present, that there's some form of economic exclusion that's connected. And that's where a pretty deep connection with class gets built into racial oppression, but also political and cultural exclusion. And it'll vary historically where the real bite is. It's another distinctive feature of 20th century anti-Semitism in Europe, in Germany, that German Jews were not excluded politically and economically. They were fully assimilated into German society, and it's one of the things that made it so shocking to people was that this wasn't a case where a minority that was in an economically subordinated position was scapegoated and given these negative status attributes. It was a group that was fully integrated. The fourth point, racial classification distinctions become stable. Socially reproducible forms of exclusion when they are systematically connected to communal identities. That is the thing which makes these stable rather than idiosyncratic, rather than just some people having views about some other group. What they become socially stable is when they become connected to communal identities. Racial oppression can be then defined racial oppression is grounded in biological lineages embodied in communal identities. So it's this connection between a biological lineage on the one hand and a communal identity on the other that renders these forms of classification and domination stable and reproducible. Finally, point five, when racial division takes the form of racial oppression, the oppressed group is also invariably stigmatized, given inferior social status, in the extreme case regarded as an inferior type of human being, in the biological, not just social sense. And sometimes, even more extreme, they're seen as not really human, as subhuman. It is possible that the stigmatization and status denigration can continue even if the exclusions have largely disappeared. But I think that's rare rather than the common. I think that the stigmatization is reinforced intergenerationally through the mechanisms of exclusion. but anti-Semitism in Germany was an example where the exclusions had been gone for a couple of generations, and yet the stigmatization was still alive. Now note, this provisional definition of the distinctively racialized form of oppression doesn't make any specific reference to class. Right, so there's some points where class brushes up against it, especially in my point two, where racial division becomes oppression when it corresponds to some socially significant exclusion. typically with an economic dimension, right? So that's where class comes into play, but it's still only one of a variety of ways in which division and oppression become, division gets transformed into oppression. Now, as a matter of fact, I think historically, the creation of forms of racial domination is often, certainly in the American context it was, directly the result of the way in which class and this form of social division were connected. In American slavery, indeed, there were attempts at having, initially in the earliest years of the colonies, near forms of slavery of whites by whites, and it turned out to be just much harder to reproduce and to sustain than slavery that was color-coded. So both for the kind of practical, logistical purposes of being able to know who is a slave and who isn't that without trouble, and the ideological purposes of being able to justify the subordination of one group by another, connecting that particular form of class relations to a racial division turned out to be a very stable way of doing it. So you could have a emerging liberal capitalist social order based on individualism in the market that justified slavery. On the face of it, that's an impossible combination. How can you have the Declaration of Independence written by a slave owner? You know, it seems an impossible combination. It turns out to be a possible combination, I think, because of race. I don't think Thomas Jefferson could have written the Declaration of Independence if he was the owner of white slaves. That is to have no racially underwritten division would have made those social relations simply too vulnerable to incoherence. Yeah?
Would that have been more of a class division then?
Well, slavery was a class division. It's an absolute class division. Slave owners...
But if it had been that way, it couldn't happen because it was a class division instead of a race division.
The point is, in a liberal capitalist order in which life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is declared as natural rights, how can you declare those as natural rights unless own slaves unless slavery is connected to some other social division which enables you to denigrate the slave and regard them as incapable of acting as full members of the community? And race does a very good job of that. Race does a good job of that because of its connection to biological lineage and because of its identifiability. Okay, let's... So that's the very abstract discussion about how to think about this category. Racial division is a particular form of communal division. It gets its force from the communal solidarities, which are its raw materials, but it mobilizes them by connecting them to biological lineages rather than to other kinds of communal divisions. And then it has this particular advantage because of the connection to observable traits. The observable features of people are what makes it a relatively easy social relation to keep in place. All right, now let's turn more specifically to the question of class and race. In thinking about racial oppression and their link to class structure, I think the most important questions are not so much what is the origins of racial inequality. The origins question has relevance, but I don't think that's the central issue. Where does it come from? But rather, what explains the durability of racial divisions and the difficulty of eliminating them? How do we understand the robustness of this form of social division? The central claim of class analysis, I think, would be that it's the interaction of race and class that is crucial to understanding the robustness of racial domination. Now, you don't have to take it one step further and say that it's the interactions of racial class that fully explains the robustness of racial domination. But the class analysis claim is that it's a key part of the process by which racial domination is reproduced over time. A key part of the process comes through its interconnection with class. That is transparently clear, I think, in the case of slavery. The reproduction of racial domination in slavery came to a significant extent from the interconnection between race and class, namely the slave system of class relations corresponded tightly to the racial order in ways that deepened and reproduced the racial division itself. And the particular intensity of the cultural forms of understanding of human difference that got built up around racism in through that connection to class, I think has been a legacy in American history ever since. A typical question that gets asked about the connection between race and class, and a difficult one to give definitive answers to, is the question, who benefits from racism? This has been one of the ways that people have approached this problem of how to think about the interactions between race and class. And there's basically four positions that have been elaborated in this discussion. And I think all four positions, in one way or another, continue to be present in contemporary discussions, although this particular framing of the debate has become less common than it was 15 or 20 years ago. So let me just briefly mention each of these positions, each of these answers to the question, who benefits from racism? First, white workers exploit black workers. There is basically a transfer of surplus from black workers to white workers. If this is true, this really means that black and white workers are distinct classes, not just a division within a class. If it's really the case that white workers exploit black workers, that labor, surplus labor performed by black workers are transferred to white workers, that that's the key relation, then they do constitute separate classes. This is the strong version of the internal colonialism thesis. This was quite popular in the 1970s among certain currents within Marxism. White workers and white capitalists form a racial alliance because they share common interests in the exploitation of blacks. White workers would be worse off if black workers simply disappeared. Right, so that's the little kind of test. If black workers simply disappeared, would white workers be better or worse off? Well, if they would be worse off in the absence of black workers, that's at least suggestive of them being in alliance with white capitalists. It's been argued that in the heyday of apartheid in South Africa, that was actually the situation for substantial segments of the white working class, that a substantial segments of the white working class were net beneficiaries of racism. It's not just that they were less exploited by virtue of blacks being more exploited, that they were not exploited, that they were full recipients of a share of the surplus generated by blacks. The fact that there was a period where most but not all white workers had black servants, for example, would be an indicator of the fact that the racial order of apartheid was so severe and the numbers of people were such, there were relatively few white workers and lots of black workers, that one could argue that that really does fit this internal colonialism model. Second position is that white workers oppress black workers but do not exploit them. They benefit from exclusionary practices, but they don't receive transfers. This is the kind of split labor market theory. White workers would not be worse off if black workers disappeared. So they don't actually benefit from those, from the labor of blacks. They benefit from being able to exclude them from jobs. So white workers who controlled craft unions and wouldn't let blacks get those jobs, their children were able to get those jobs at a higher rate than they would have otherwise. So they benefit from the exclusion. But if the black workers just disappeared, they would still benefit from the exclusion. So they're not exploiting, but they are engaged in a form of oppression. So they're participants in the domination, and thus the accusation that racism, that they're contributing to the perpetuation of racism because they're benefiting in some way from the exclusion is correct. But they don't form the same kind of alliance with white capitalists that the first theory supports. The third position is that white workers neither oppress nor exploit black workers. Rather, capitalists differentially exploit different categories of workers, but all workers suffer from this differential exploitation. This would be the traditional Marxist analysis, where white workers don't actually benefit. It's an illusion that they benefit from the exclusion of black workers from certain labor markets. That exclusion actually weakens the white working class as well as the black working class. Differential exploitation of blacks and whites creates antagonism within the working class, creates conflict between black and white workers, and this weakens all workers' struggles against capitalists. Sometimes this is seen as a deliberate strategy by capitalists, divide and conquer. Other times it's seen as a more functionalist kind of relation from which capitalists benefit. But in this framework, capitalists alone benefit from racism. There's some very nice empirical research done in the 1970s, for example. Michael Reich, I think there's in the, I'm not sure if I assigned it or not in the readings. There's an article, a famous book by Michael Reich and some related articles from the 1970s, in which he looked at the inequality between black and white workers in different labor markets in the United States. And his argument was that where that inequality was greatest, white workers' wages would be lowest, not highest. And the argument was that the degree of inequality between black and white labor indicated the degree of racial division between black and white workers, and that should correspond to a weaker working class, which would make all workers work worse off. So the less racial inequality within the working class, the higher the wages of all workers would be. And that was, I think, certainly supportive evidence for the claim that white workers don't benefit from racial inequality, that it's an illusion. They might think they benefit. You know, they see black workers as much worse off than they are and think, aha, I've got to continue excluding them, because otherwise I'll be as bad off as they are. But they've got the wrong counterfactual. If we didn't exclude them, we'd be more solidaristic, we'd be able to fight better. And therefore, everybody's wages would go up. Finally, the most recent position, which is, I think, probably first or most famously advocated by Bill Wilson, and although he doesn't say it this way, the differential exploitation of black and white workers is of decreasing relevance to the analysis of contemporary society. The key issue is not, at the present, is not that blacks are exploited more than whites. That's no longer the driving kind of mechanism of race, of the race-class connection. Rather, it's the increasing marginalization of segments of the black population from the system of exploitation altogether. The analysis of the black underclass is not an analysis of hyper-exploitation of blacks, it's of marginalization of blacks. It's saying that a segment of the black population is oppressed but not consistently exploited. They've been marginalized from the central processes of exploitation through a variety of mechanisms. But that marginalization creates then the economic foundation, the economic base, if you will, for the reproduction of racial antagonism. But now it's an antagonism that occurs within the black population as well, not just between the white population and the black population. Yeah?
You mentioned the name of the person who might put this thesis forward. What name is that?
Of this last one? Bill Wilson, William Julius Wilson.
Oh, okay.
The Declining Significance of Race. This is how I would interpret his book, The Declining Significance of Race, and the and his second book, The Truly Disadvantaged, those two books together, I think argue that there still is a key economic foundation to racial antagonism, but it's not from differential exploitation, it's from marginalization. Yeah?
Do you think that Louis Wachmann would be like similar in this?
I think his arguments could be interpreted in these terms, sure. Yeah. That marginalization creates, and the argument that Elijah Anderson gave in the sociology department colloquium last week about this particularly salient role that the ghetto plays in reproducing racial antagonism, racial conflict, racial stereotyping, that's also connected to this. Yes, Maddie.
But if it's
So it becomes very complicated, which from a sociological point of view is super interesting. From a human point of view, it's filled with tragedy. The marginalization of a significant, it's still not a majority. It's a minority of African Americans are really marginalized in this way, but it's a salient segment. That marginalization does create a class cleavage within the African American population. That's historically quite new. That has not been a central feature of the condition of being African American historically. It has not been a central condition that there is a strong black middle class that has conflict with an impoverished, marginalized segment of the black population. So it does generate class antagonism inside of the black population, but it still has a racialized character. Right, so it still has this racialized character through its identification with the black underclass. It's not just the poor, it's the black underclass. That's the that's the symbolic embodiment of this condition. And that then has ramifications for the lives of relatively advantaged African Americans because they get saddled with the baggage, so to speak, the symbolic baggage because of the history of racism. You know, again, it's all of these things get culturally represented and embodied. Because of that history, they have to contend with their white colleagues, so to speak, thinking of the black underclass as simply the black population. And that then creates what Elijah Anderson regards as this constant struggle by black professionals and middle class to demonstrate that they are not like that in a way that white professionals don't have to demonstrate. You know, I don't have to ever go into a store and show that I'm not a black ghetto male, whereas a black colleague of mine would have to act in ways to clearly differentiate himself from that stigmatized category. And that's a racialized form of oppression, but with a very different texture from the historic ones. Well, that's probably United Airlines telling me that either the flight's canceled or it's on time, one or the other. Let's just hope it's the other. Okay. I think we should take our break. When we come back, I'm going to wrap this up with just a few minutes. There's a few sort of loose ends, and then we can have our discussion, okay? Let's start again at 1:15.